This is Claire Douglas, 12 January 2001. Visions, Seminars, What It Can Teach Us About the Psyche, Tape 1 of 1.
As an analyst, I can't start now until I ask, why did you ask the question? Yeah. Well, they're hard going, but well worth your while. I want to talk a bit about some of the historical and personal antecedents to the vision seminars tonight and to Jung's psychology, and about Jung's discovery of active imagination and how he used it himself and then with others. Am I too loud? Okay. Tonight I'm concentrating on Jung and the vision seminars and what that tells us about women's psychology and also about the development of a whole lot of other theories, issues in Jungian psychology. Tomorrow, I'm going to concentrate on Christiana Morgan, and I think I'm the only human being right at this present moment who has access to all the slides, all the pictures of her visions, her original visions, not the ones Jung was used, but the complete ones. And we'll have, each time I do it, it is a great privilege to share them with people. They are beautiful, they're wonderful. They show a marvelous initiatory quest. And that's what I'll be doing tomorrow. Plus, depending on people's extroversion or interest or whatever. It's not a bad word, extroversion. we will be doing some active imagination ourselves, or I will share with you some patients who've given me permission their active imagination, or a little bit of both. I want to also cover a bit on active imagination and its start, and who Christiana Morgan, the subject of Jung's longest series of seminars, was, and what I feel is the vision seminar's importance today. Jung focused on those aspects of Morgan's visions which exemplify his theory. He fragmented Morgan's visions in order to examine bits and pieces. He skipped parts of entire visions or series of them, and on no occasion presented any vision uninterrupted from start to finish, because that wasn't his purpose. Instead, he gave his followers a specific and detailed analysis of the way the collective unconscious can be perceived in a patient's material. Before this, when people were talking about archetypes, animus, anima, collective unconscious, so on, there was nothing that really demonstrated it. And this was one of the first long teaching seminars where Jung was not teaching... he was teaching theory, but he was teaching theory grounded in a woman's experience and in a woman's visions. The seminars make an excellent teaching manual and a practical demonstration of Jung's theories. Jung used the visions to teach his analysands and students about the creative manifestation of the unconscious in analysis and to demonstrate the way his system of analysis taps into the healing power of symbolic archetypal content. He accomplished this task brilliantly. And I don't know of others who've read the vision seminars, but for me, despite my irritation with parts of it, it is by far my favorite book of Jung's. He accomplished his task, as I said, brilliantly. As he puts it, quote, "These lectures are about the development, one could say, of the transcendent function out of dreams, and the actual images which ultimately serve in the synthesis of the individual, the reconciliation of the pairs of opposites, and the whole problem of symbol formation. considered by many the most original, broadly educated, and philosophical of any depth psychologist, Jung inhabited a specific era whose scientific thought and popular culture formed the bedrock out of which analytic and much of modern psychology has developed. Jung grew up in the German-speaking part of Switzerland during the final quarter of the 19th century. Being a Swiss citizen gave Jung a sense of daily order and stability, but the austere, pragmatic, industrious Swiss character, at least the German Swiss character, contrasts with the other side of his character and with Switzerland's flagrantly romantic typography. And those two bits, the romantic and the practical, are throughout Jung's work and make a tension in his work that, to me, makes it far more interesting than many other psychologists' work. Jung created his theories at a particular moment in history, synthesizing a wide variety of contemporary thought through the filter of his own personal psychology. Jung believed that all psychological theories reflect the personal history of their creators, declaring, quote, "Our way of looking at things is conditioned by what we are." In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Jung wrote about his parents in both archetypal and personal ways and connected his interest in the feminine to his experience of his mother nature. I was thinking when I was rereading these notes in the plane today that I don't know anyone other than an analyst who would start talking about a book and the visions by going into Jung and his parents. To me, that's vital, is to make the links back to see, well, who is this? Why is this? What happened that, you know, what happened that all of you are sitting here tonight? What are the elements that bring you there? In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, Jung wrote about his parents in both archetypal and personal ways. In the original text, Jung wrote far more about his mother's depressions and her mental instability than in the published version. When Jung was three, his feeling of what I'd term her neglect was exacerbated by an actual physical breakdown. She was hospitalized for several months. This separation from his mother was experienced by him as great abandonment, and it had a profound psychological effect on him. It formed a simultaneous, unquenchable longing for, yet deep distrust for the feminine. And I'm quoting now from Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. "From then on, I always felt mistrustful when the word love was spoken. The feeling I associated with woman was for a long time that of unreliability. Father, on the other hand, meant reliability and powerlessness. That is the handicap I started off with. I've mistrusted women and I wasn't disappointed." End of quote. Part of the vision seminars for me is his working through this and trying to work through it and again hitting his head against it. Letting the visions carry him along and suddenly saying, "Nope, don't trust this." In his autobiography, Jung described his mother as a split personality, a split which he acknowledged he inherited, both having what he called a number one and a number two personality. For the most part, his mother maintained her number one personality, which Jung described as down-to-earth, practical, and commonplace, with little to offer her more intellectual son. Her number two personality was sensitive and intuitive, with marked parapsychological abilities, which filled the boy with fear and awe of her uncanny power, but which he also shared with her. And some of the most interesting work to me being done today, which Tom Kirsch may talk about next week or next month or whenever your next meeting is the influence of parapsychology on analytical psychology and the whole stream of interest in unconscious phenomena, ESP, parapsychology, that is coming alive today but that many people trying to make Jung respectable have sort of downplayed. I think it's vital that it be included. And I have not read Tom's book yet, but I hope that he has a part on what's called the new Jungian studies. Jung was far more his mother's than his father's son. This gives weight to the emphasis he places upon the feminine in his psychology and provides a way rare for the time in which the feminine was examined and valued, even though still in relation to the masculine. The importance of this to Jung's personal confession, analytical psychology, needs to be stressed. It leaves an opening through which the power of the feminine can enter though, as true for Jung's time, not as equal colleague of the male. Jung's not altogether successful struggle to integrate these split aspects of his mother and to integrate his own mother complex in both its positive and negative aspects may be some of his chief sources of his interest in women and the feminine and his willingness to explore his female patient psyches. By understanding and healing them, he may finally understand and heal his own mother's world. Scholars have suggested that perhaps ultimately the source of Jung's emphasis on the creative unconscious itself comes from his need to free himself from the potentially engulfing world of the mothers. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. It's because when you really examine something for its positive aspects, like the creative aspects of the unconscious, then you're not defending against the unconscious's pull on you. Negatively, however, Jung's personal reaction to his troubled mother and his unintegrated and split mother complex has been left an aspect of his theory on the psychology of women that we, his followers, need to work through, as well as finding our own middle ground between Jung's ambivalent love-hate relationship with parapsychology, mysticism, and Eastern religions. Jung, it seems, never entirely healed this split. In object relations terminology, we call it the split between the Kleinian good breast, bad breast. But he retained the belief that both he and his mother were divided into number one and number two personalities. It is part of his immensely creative work on self-healing that neither part was repressed nor became demonic. Instead, Jung developed a theory which sought to integrate these and other opposites in every respect. So that's a little bit on his parents. Now on his education. Jung benefited from an education whose extent and thoroughness is rarely encountered today. It was a comprehensive schooling in the Protestant theological tradition, in classical Greek and Latin literature, and in European history and philosophy. Jung's university teachers held an almost religious belief in the possibilities of positivistic science and faith in the scientific method. Positivism gave Jung invaluable training in and respect for empirical science. Jung's medical psychiatric background is clearly revealed in his empirical research, his absolutely brilliantly careful clinical observations and case histories, his skill in diagnosis, and in his formulation of projective tests. This rigorous scientific attitude, key though it was not congenial to him and many of his fellow students. Romantic philosophy was far more. It was a contrasting lens which reflected the geography of Switzerland and presented a dramatic, many-layered view of the world. Romanticism, instead of focusing on objective particulars, turned toward the irrational, toward inner individual reality, and toward the exploration of the unknown and enigmatic, whether in myth, ancient realms, exotic countries and peoples, hermetic religions, or altered mental states. Romantic philosophy eschewed the linear in favor of circumambulation, one of my favorite Linnean words. contemplating an object from many different angles and perspectives, walking around it. Romanticism preferred Platonic ideals to Aristotelian lists and focuses on unchanging ideal forms behind the rational world rather than worldly movement or the accumulation of data. In Jung's youth, this ideal of original wholeness was echoed in the romantic belief in the unity of all nature. Yet at the same time, the romantics acutely felt their own separation from nature and longed for the ideal. Thus, romanticism gave voice to a transcendental yearning for lost Edens, for the unconscious, and for depth, emotion, and simplicity, which in turn led to the study of the outer natural world and the soul within. With the rise of romanticism, men started not only to explore unknown continents in themselves, but also to look at and revalue what they considered their opposite, women, whom they endowed with the unconsciousness, irrationality, depth, and emotions that were forbidden to rational men. I think it's a great, great shame. Men examined women from a male standpoint. What else was there? And women, at least overtly at that time, acquiesced. Claiming the objectivity of positivistic science, many tended to cultivate theories that were based on sexual romanticism instead. In the scientists' and novelists' imagination, women were the mysterious and fascinating other, a feminine whose fragile romantic vulnerability the masculine could not permit in itself. At the same time, they gave women mysterious psychic powers and a power often reduced to the negative and the erotic. And if any of you are analysts or therapists, or if you're men who are in analysis, what I just said is a perfect description of a certain type of anima figure. Mysterious, dark, elusive, so on. The actual increase in women's power and her demands for emancipation during the latter half of the 19th century served to increase men's ambivalence and anxiety. Women in Europe and the United States were starting a concerted struggle to obtain education and independence. There were no women students at Swiss universities until the 1890s. As a medical student and as a philosopher, Jung was affected by this particular strain of romantic imagination and its beliefs about women. Like his fellow romantics, Jung remained deeply drawn to the feminine, yet equally ambivalent. He acknowledged his own feminine side, studied it, and the women around him through the lens of romanticism, and formed his ideas of women accordingly. The strains of positivism and romanticism warred in Jung's education and training, but also produced a dialectical synthesis in which Jung could use the most advanced method of reason and scientific accuracy to establish the reality of the irrational. James Hillman and Rauscher have a wonderful quote describing this as that people could be at one and at the same time, quote, Western, modern, secular, civilized, insane, but also primitive, archaic, mythical, and mad, end of quote. The end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th brought with them an era of unprecedented creativity. Jung's enthusiasm echoed the ferment reverberating in the philosophy and science he was studying, in the newer psychological texts he found. He decided to become an analyst after staying up all night one night reading Kraft Ebbing on, what is it called? Oddities of Sexual Experience, something like that. It has a Latin name, but that's a loose translation. In the novels he was reading, in discourse with his friends, and in finding himself one of the torchbearers of the synthesis of romanticism and positivism. Jung's brilliance and erudition need to be appreciated for their vital role in the creation of analytical psychology. So much that was mind-bogglingly, exhilaratingly novel then, has since entered the Jungian canon. Both Jung and Freud approached the problem of women's psychology by constructing dualistic theories, defining women in terms of their relation to men or as men's polar opposites. Too often, what the two wrote in admitted tentativeness about the feminine became a received truth in the minds of their followers. Underneath Jung's and Freud's view of the feminine lay deeply entrenched ideas about women and their status, which the analytic pioneers didn't recognize as unconscious assumptions. Roazen, for example, in his study of the era and the people around Freud, writes, quote, "Western culture at the turn of the 20th century generally looked down on women who are supposed to exist primarily for the sake of gratifying a man's need, bearing his children, and running his house," end of quote. That's Ted Roazen, and it's Freud and his followers. A fascinating book. This brings us back to Jung's mother and her number two personality, seen here as the feminine who is the problem. If Jung had had a mother whom he experienced as less divided and less powerful, such as Freud's mother, he would not have needed to struggle so to come to terms with the feminine. He could have ignored the whole question of relationship to the feminine, or, like Freud, relegated her to the negative position of inferiority. For Jungian psychology, Jung's problems with the feminine opened analytical psychology to the study of feminine and women. It finally gave women a standing place from which to evaluate and reevaluate her own psychology and continually enriches our understanding of ourselves. It also leaves us, his followers, with the task of analyzing what we mean when we refer to the feminine. Can it be deduced simply from studying a man's anima, or is there a psychology that's specifically women's? And I don't think, as Jungian psychologists or analysts, we've answered that yet. I'm going to skip this and skip this. You're not missing anything. You're missing things on social conditioning. Do you need definitions? Anima, animus, archetype? Ha, good. All right. Jung's chief study of the feminine is the Vision Seminar, which is also his most extensive presentation of a patient's case material. The Vision Seminars, this is volume one, there's also another volume, contains 1,379 pages covering 86 lectures that Jung gave during 11 terms for 4 years, from October 1930 to March 1934. Jung had given a short seminar on the visions in German in 1930, and there was a demand for one in English. In the English seminar, Jung discussed parts of 44 of Morgan's initial visions and got about one-third of the way through the material he had planned to cover in 4 years. The history behind these seminars needs, and he stopped. He stopped one-third way through, thinking that he was going to go on, stopped suddenly. Both because the seminar people were getting restless, a lot of the discussion was getting further and further away from the subject, and it wasn't the way, possibly at that time, moment time in history, to study the feminine. And what they switched to was fascinating. They switched to the Nietzsche seminars, which is studying probably the most dark, destructive anima. I can image it, I can't really put words to it. But it was right for the time moment. And I'll get a little back to that of why it was. that it's very important to know the history of when this, when Jung was dealing with this. Yes? That preceded this one. The dream seminar came first, then, I can't remember, then there were some other seminars, and then the vision seminar, and then the Nietzsche seminar. Oh, yes. Yeah. 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 Yeah, the timing was all off. It was, well, I know about this as an introverted thinking type. You can get an idea and then you just go on and then it leads to this and then it leads to that. And like, I'm wondering if you're thinking, when's this woman going to get into the vision seminars? Yeah, but it was. And whether that was Jung, whether it was the material, whether it was the people he was lecturing to, or whether it was Europe in chaos in the late 1930s. All right. The history behind these seminars needs to be understood in order to value active imagination and the seminars appropriately. Jung had first sketched out his theories about archetypes in the collective unconscious, though without yet using this terminology, in 1911 and 1912, by analyzing the fantasies of a Miss Frank Miller, who was not personally known to him. The resulting book, and anyone who knows German will excuse me, Von Lungen und Symbole der Libido, Psychology of the Unconscious, later revised as Symbols of Transformation, not only signaled his approaching break with Freud, it provided Jung with a rationale for investigating his own fantasies while exploring the depth of the unconscious. Thus, after the publication of this book, still deeply shaken by his recent rupture with Freud and the end of his relationship with Freud and his hopes of being part of that group, he found he couldn't rely on any of the things that had helped him in the past, such as scholarship or reading that had supported him. So what he did was, first of all, just see what came to mind or see what happened. And he found himself out playing with stones like he had as a child. You remember as a kid, you know, making, especially in Seattle, I guess, making channels for water to come around and putting dams in front of them and so on. Well, he did that and found that it gave him some peace. So he allowed himself just to keep doing that. Then he went deeper to explore his inner turmoil and his search for a way to facilitate and make any sense of it. And I would say that to also cure a depression. He dropped into an altered, almost hypnopompic state of consciousness, not unlike that of Miss Miller and of the mediums who had so fascinated him in his youth. Jung stayed awake, however, with part of his ego always present to monitor and then record what emerged. Joan Chatterow, in a book called Jung on Active Imagination, which Princeton published in his excerpts of all his writings on active imagination, except for the vision seminars. Anyway, she wrote a wonderful description of Jung and active imagination. Quote, Jung began to experiment with specific meditative practices, various rites of entree to engage his fantasies. For example, he was sitting at his desk one day when he made a conscious decision to drop down into the depths. He landed on his feet and began to explore the strange inner landscape where he met the first of a long series of inner figures. These fantasies seemed to personify his fears and other powerful emotions. Over time, he realized that when he managed to translate his emotions into images, he was inwardly calmed and reassured. He tried different ways to enter into his fantasies voluntarily. Sometimes he imagined climbing down a steep descent. Other times he imagined digging a hole. He used a number of expressive techniques, mainly writing, drawing, and painting, to give symbolic form to his experience. End of quote. I'd also add sculpting. Chodoro makes an important point that neither Jung nor active imagination propose merging or identifying with the unconscious contents, but instead giving them symbolic expression, maintaining a reflective view of what he let himself uncover, which is an idea of the term transcendent function, that you've got the unconscious on one side and you've got the image, and having them both together then can produce a state that is far superior and far more healing than the original state. A self-analysis ensued by means of this examination of his archetypal imagery. It was Jung's analog to Freud's famous self-analysis. As visions of previously unexplored realms of the unconscious emerged, Jung transcribed his active imaginations into two elaborate parchment books, his red book and his black book. And if any of you are going to Zurich, go to Kusnacht, go to the library, and see if you can see them. They're wonderful. Did you see them when you were in, some librarians kept them very private, and sometimes they let people see them, and sometimes they're behind glass, and you can see a page or so. But it's well worth looking. The privately bound volumes contain paintings and a text that are almost hieratic in their archetypal intensity. Now I'm getting to the vision seminars. 13 years later, at the age of 51, Jung was on firm ground again with a theoretical platform in place, a large practice, and many demands on his time. Yet in 1926, there was still no formal program to explicate his psychological theories for his growing number of followers, no training center, and no institution, no instruction other than analysis and what students could glean from Jung's books, his occasional lectures, and the once-a-week seminar series that he'd started. Also, there were his wife was starting to analyze people, Tony Wolf was starting to analyze people, a few other people were, but it was mostly Jung. When Jung no longer had as much time to give each analysand as he previously provided, he began searching for something the analysand could do independently that would intensify analysis and expand its range. Looking back to his own dreams and fantasies for a clue to what might now help his patients, Jung decided to encourage the greater use of active imagination, which he also sometimes referred to as trancing or visioning, as a clinical and therapeutic tool. It was just at the time of Christiana Morgan's arrival in Zurich that Jung started to include active imagination as one of the things an analysand could do. Christiana Morgan and her husband, William Morgan, and the theatrical set designer, Robert Edmund Jones, Jonah, came to Jung during the same summer of 1926. All three showed a lively fervor and marked talent for what they called trancing. They shared their visions and paintings with each other, actively discussing them together. Joseph Henderson, who was there at the time, he's an analyst who's in San Francisco, helped form the San Francisco Jung Institute, relates that this trio's vivacity, wit, and style contributed to Jung's enthusiasm for active imagination. Their presence and the very extravagance of their imagining and possibly of active imagination itself caused quite a stir. There were stories, this was Joe Wheelwright's story, of walking down the street and seeing a woman, that was Barbara Hanna, as if she was a mad woman, going this down the street. This, said, "Hello, what's going on?" "Shh, I'm having a discussion with my something or other." So they were starting to do this in public. this, it was a different time, but I also think that Morgan and her husband and Jones were quite mischievous, because they used to enact their active imaginations on the lawn outside of where some of the studies were being held. And you must know that Zurich was a very serious place, right? Yes. I think Jung enjoyed that. He reveled in Morgan's and Jones' gracefully light humor and their capacity to have fun, as well as their effect on other members of the Zurich group, who were quite outraged. At the start of this seminar, Jung describes Morgan as an American. He keeps her, who she is, quiet, though it leaked out during the seminars. So this is several years after she was there. At the start of the seminar, Jung describes Morgan as an American, about 30, married and with a small child, who has recently come to him for help because of the psychic turbulence caused by some unspecified love problem. She is described as, got this all color-coded, our patient is a woman about 30 years of age. She's highly educated, very intelligent, a typical intellectual with an almost mathematical mind. She's a natural scientist by education and exceedingly rational. She has a great deal of intuition, which really ought to function, but is repressed because it yields irrational results, and that's very disagreeable to the rational mind. Such a case, a mental attitude of such a character, is likely to come up against a situation early in life where that attitude becomes useless. If fate is benevolent, one soon gets into a tight spot. If fate is not benevolent, it allows one to live a long time with such an attitude, and so one loses a lot of opportunities in life. This woman got into a hole at about 30. That's pretty decent. Obviously, her fate is benevolent. It has given her a chance at 30. Other people have only their chance at 45 or 50. I've seen people even at 60 who finally discovered that they've only seen half of the world, that they had lived only half of their life, which is, of course, a very sad discovery of that age. People with such a one-sided development of their thinking function. So he sees that she's a thinking type here. Have on the other side an inferior feeling function, because feeling is the opposite of thinking. The feeling is then archaic and has all the advantages and disadvantages of an archaic function. The inferior function is generally characterized by traits of primitive psychology, above all by participation mystique. That is, it makes one peculiarly identical with other people or with other situations. Our patient had the feeling that circumstances gave her. She could think hypothetically, but she couldn't feel hypothetically. As a matter of fact, her intelligence was so highly developed that she thought things that the people in her environment didn't think. She even made it her ideal to be unlike other people. And because her thinking was so differentiated and so different from other people's, it put her into a strange position with everyone. There was no approach, no bridge to her. She was secluded, an ivory tower, and she naturally suffered from that ice-cold isolation. Now her inferior feeling is in the foundations of that ivory tower and has secret passages, underground ways where it can escape. And because it is blind like a mole, one doesn't know where it'll turn up. But you can be sure it establishes connections somewhere. If you're absolutely isolated, like a lighthouse in the sea, so that nobody can approach, if you are perfect in your perfectly differentiated function, then underneath something escapes into the night. It digs underground passages and bores into other people, perhaps. This woman is rational, married, propagating the species, everything's quite all right, yet she's completely isolated. So it's quite inevitable when not living in relatedness, that feeling simply cannot climb to the heights of the head. It's overwhelmed and apparently disappears, but reappears projected upon a man, who of course is not the husband. That is this woman's case, and there are similar cases with men. The lack of relatedness is then compensated by a sudden magic relationship, a fascination, a participation mystique. Therefore, it's usually love at first sight in the most compulsory form of love. It is natural that our patient suffered from such a problem, which means the ultimate conflict between her rational thinking and her primitive nature and feeling. If anyone says that Jung can't write, if anyone says he's dry, he's impossible, I think he's marvelous. This is so alive. And can you imagine sitting there hearing this? All right. Onward. The psychological problems, as Jung said, that brought Morgan to Jung seem to have been an undifferentiated and primitive feeling function, a sexual or love problem, a father complex, all of which to me to echo a deeply spiritual crisis. I would add to this list my sense of a further problem. Being a woman, powerfully gifted and creative in her own right, in a culture and milieu which had no room for her, gave her great difficulties. When I was reading her notebooks, reading her letters, studying her life, talking to people who knew her, reading love letters people had written her, talking to people who were her students, who had been her lovers, so on, what struck me was, first of all, her combination of human fragility and nobility, of the obsessive quality of her interest in whoever she was attached to, the erotically charged enigma of Murray's, her lover's, great lover in the vision seminars anyway, and in most of her life, the enigma of Murray's hold on her and she on him. The visions were a way for her to understand archetypal dimensions of her love and to find her own way through the obsession and to reclaim or develop her feeling, her damaged feeling function. What strikes me also as a list of her problems was a kind of unmet human hunger that she couldn't put into words, a deep loneliness and sadness, a sense of alienation, a sense of a void or wound deep within herself. This, her own personality, Jung's interest in her, all worked together to create a very hot alchemical mixture that gave her analysis a burning intensity. She showed amazing diligence and dedication and discipline in creating the visions. She gave herself time to vision, and then the care in which she transcribed and illustrated it. And I know all of us with jobs and children and responsibilities may envy the time she had in Zurich, because she was there, her child was in London being taken care of by a good nanny, her husband was mostly in London, and so all she did was dedicate herself to her analysis. And that's what a number of people in Zurich were doing at that time. If any of you have read, what is it, of Glass, World of Glass? Is that the name of it? Worlds of Glass. Yeah, that describes some other people who are in Zurich. And the hothouse of this kind of work, but also the enormous privilege of it. Kafka once wrote that literature was an axe wielded against the frozen sea within us. An axe wielded against the frozen sea within us. The visions were Christiana's axe, and it broke through her frozen feeling. She fitted few of the stereotypical requirements of the yin half of the mandala. She was beautiful, witty, and intuitive, but she cherished ideas, not feeling. She often related to men through ideas, which she could easily do because of her positive father complex. and it attracted men to her and allowed her to idealize the men it brought her way. But she was also sometimes cold and remote. And that I heard from Henry Murray, her lover, from her son, from her grandchildren, from another lover of hers, from a student. Perhaps intuitively, she was able to come up with an unprecedented production of artistic and imaginative archetypal material just when this was the stuff that would interest her doctor most. Jung had published Symbols of Transformation, completed his break from Freud, and after a healing experience of his own depths, produced Psychological Types. But he was struggling to find ways to bring his own understanding of the value of archetypal After Jung instructed her in active imagination, Jung found she possessed something he'd only met before in himself, the equivalent of perfect pitch, a gift enabling her to enter the realm of collective unconscious with accurate immediacy, to open herself to its images and afterwards to translate them coherently in words as well as by painting parts of them. Jung's own path in his self-analysis and his similar gift for visual thinking made him able to understand Morgan's analogous journey and thereby help her embark on a series of archetypal adventures that dazzle in their virtuosity. And it's as if in alchemy, the Frater Mystica, the alchemist, needs his Soror Mystica, the Soror needs the Frater. There they were, both of them, both interested, both the same typology, both interested in active imagination, both producing these same kind of visions. According to Morgan's notes, although Jung downplayed and sometimes seemed to deny this in the seminars, he spent many of their analytic sessions dealing with her fantasies, initially warning her of the enormous power of the unconscious and its many dangers. As Morgan's visions started to become more detailed and more powerful, Jung urged her to refine her illustrations of them in a way that paralleled his own. And the importance of drawing an active imagination is something that I wish that we as analysts emphasized more. Jung says about the importance of drawing or painting, there are certain happenings in the development of the human psyche where things become particularly confused and dark, and people become incoherent and can't express themselves in words. Situations come up in dreams which seem to be very clear, but as soon as you're back in the conscious state, everything is blurred, and you find it exceedingly difficult to describe what you actually experience. You have no words to explain these inchoate situations. There are many thoughts which cannot be thought clearly, and there are many inner experiences which are apparent only to the inner eye or heart, whatever you like to call that organ. It seems perfectly simple there, but human language is inadequate. Then people take to drawing. Also, certain experiences in dreams or visions are so expressive, so full of color and plastic life, that they recommend themselves to the dreamer, and he naturally yields to the temptation to reproduce what he's seen. So there are all sorts of reasons why people take to it. Of course, when I see that the quality of my patient's experiences suggest representation, I encourage them, because I've learned through long experience, about 14 years, when to encourage the people to whom it's useful. It helps them to concretize inner events. For most people are suffering from the prejudice that they're not real because they can't be handled or even talked about in a logical way. In such a case, the drawing is invaluable. It concretizes. It makes a statement so that other people can see it. It is there in reality as if painted on the wall, and then they begin to think it does exist. So it both gives it a reality, and it also takes some of the horror or the terror or the fear or the spookiness from something. So I suggest anyone try, if they have anything that they can't quite get at, just scribble. And if you have a hang-up about drawing and you're right-handed, do it with your left hand. Because the point is not to be artistic, it's to see what the unconscious produces. So drawing is a valuable part of active imagination. Perhaps because of the similarity in Morgan's and Jung's use of active imagination, Jung's pioneering virtuosity survives best in this series of seminars that he gave between 1925 and 1939. Here he regales his audience with news of the new worlds of the psyche he's discovering in Morgan's active imagination and that he's starting to map. He regales them with the psychological treasures he's found and the astonishing cross-cultural parallels everywhere present. In these seminars, Jung delightedly plays with ideas in romantic exuberance. Jung's vigorous and playful creativity is an essential part of analytical psychology that requires an equally vivid and imaginative response. One of the delights of the seminars in reading the Vision Seminar is their portrayal of a more leisurely age than ours, when there was a luxury of time as well as the interest to follow each symbol to its source. It's fun to wallow with the class in soaking up Jung's immense erudition. He spends a good part of the time on amplification, his method of tracking symbols and images to every conceivable origin and parallel. The brilliance of Jung's off-the-cuff associating to archetypal images may not come through to us, his more narrowly educated and impatient present-day readers, but most members of the seminar gratefully harvested his scholarship. So much of what was fresh then has since entered the Jungian canon. Now it's hard to realize the effect of Jung's magnetism as he illuminated new vistas of the mind with pioneering virtuosity. Jung could be viewed as just having returned from mapping an unknown continent where Morgan and he had traveled together, and he was sitting in some explorers' club of the psyche, regaling fellow enthusiasts with stories of the incredible sights he'd seen, riches he'd found, and the amazing similarities he discovered across time, space, and culture. Jung formed this lore into astounding parallels for himself and his listeners as he spoke. His robust joy in making arcane connections warms one's heart to him, even as the swerves and meanders of his analogies sometimes evade his subject and threaten to lose both the reader and the seminar itself. It did get lost. Who were the people he was talking to? Who were his audience? Was he talking to people in the audience, or was he lecturing from something that he just had decided and just set forth? Mostly he lectured off the cuff. He did have notes, but mostly he just talked. As one of the seminar members, Elizabeth Shepley Sargent, has emphasized in a magazine article she wrote in 1931, the seminars served many of the participants as an extension of their private analysis. Jung was not speaking to some anonymous reader, but addressing a particular group of particular individual analysands. It's of utmost importance in reading the seminars to keep this in mind. Sargent commented that Jung spoke to the needs of each person in the room and directly to their complexes. Sargent felt that he tailored the seminars to his analysand's individual psychology far more than he focused on the text. And I'd hazard a guess that the opinionating negative animus that Jung claimed to find so irritating in Morgan's visions really belonged to some of the women in the room, and that his more irritable and negative comments about Morgan might be directed at those present. Also, that they came by their negative animus very honorably. Really, no, seriously. Many of the women then in analysis with Jung had been academically trained in a form of scholarly opinionating. The first article I ever wrote was a long article, I think it was on Christopher Whitman's Return to the Goddess. And I wrote it pretty much in my own style. I'd studied writing. I was not a bad writer. And it went through an editor, a woman who'd been trained in Zurich, and came back in a form of scholarly opinionating. Dry, any asides were taken out, any of the sort of music I was making was reduced. It was the driest, dullest thing I've ever written, because of course it got published. But this is the way we were taught to speak. And also women were so often then taken to task for their feeling or for their emotion or for whatever else, that you have to be very, very careful how you phrase things. So a lot of what sounds odd to us and that irritated Jung was self-consciousness and was the form of scholarliness that was acceptable speech, especially in American universities at that time. Also, some of the women had little or no education and had little practice. So some of them were the scholars, the dry scholars, and others were people like Jane Wheelwright, who was wonderfully intelligent, but had no practice in scholarly ways or even of being allowed to speak. Do we have time for an example of this, or should I get on? Example? Okay. I'll give you an example of this kind of speech that was the correct one for women in those days. This is Toni Wolfe. I read some of her analytic notes of William Morgan's of his analysis with her, and this is fairly typical of Wolfe. Miss Wolfe, the effect of the connection with the archetype seems to me to be expressed in the dreams of the harvesting machine, for the harvest time was fixed by the Catholic Church in the month of the birth of the Virgin. And furthermore, astrologically, it comes under the sign of Virgo, which I suppose had to do with the fixing of the date by the church. Also, harvest time is related to the Demeter and Cori myth, which you mentioned in connection with the Eleusinian mysteries. So I think the dreamer, through having become identified with the archetype, is presented as a goddess of the harvest and at the same time as a modern goddess because she's related by the machines to the actual present time. Then, too, the human element comes in because the machine was made by man. Now, this is all very interesting and all very good. But where's the feeling? Where's the emotion? Where's the numinousness of, and I'll show you tomorrow this vision. This is the way a scholarly woman is trained to talk. Okay. You've never heard a lecture like that, have you? To me, that little bit from Wolfe, she's very, very different in her own work when she wrote about types and typology. But here it's an example of animist thinking, the way women were taught to think and express themselves. To get back to Jung, he answers her and says, you see, we're concerned here with a living symbol, which is not historical or archetypal. It is new, something just created. This woman is seeking an attitude which will help her to meet the problems of her life. He has permission to both be intellectual and go to Demeter and Cori, but also to come back to the the reality of the woman. Morgan has not found the conviction, this woman has not found the conviction or the attitude which would help her to accept life as it is. One cannot say life in general, but to find her own individual fate. For that, she needs a sort of religious attitude which she can find nowhere else. My reason for dealing with these visions is that they give us a really marvelous insight into the secret workings of the unconscious. They show us how the unconscious works out certain symbols by means of which she may acquire an attitude that enables her to live, not conventionally as we understand it, but to find her own specific individual life. In discussing Morgan's feminine twin to his more masculine inner journey, Jung was able to demonstrate for the first time how the archetypal image becomes humanized in analysis, and also how he worked concretely with the problems of typology and the development of the inferior function. Perhaps nowhere else does Jung so dramatically illustrate the redeeming power and effective intensity of the collective unconscious imagery that was both the center of his patient's preoccupation and the gateway to her and other of his patients' healing and development. Rather than analytical psychology becoming a body of dogma, Jung warned that his ideas were tentative at best and reflected the era in which he lived. He says, whatever happens in a given moment has inevitably the quality peculiar to that moment. That's in Collected Works 11. A large part of his experimental verve is lost on us, the less comprehensively educated contemporary reader, but was an essential part of Jung's character and also very much in tune with the spirit of the time. As a true explorer, Jung understood the limits of what he knew. He wrote that as an innovator, he had the disadvantages common to all pioneers. Quote, one stumbles through unknown regions. One is led astray by analogies, forever losing the Ariadne thread. One is overwhelmed by new impressions and new possibilities. And the worst disadvantage of all is that the pioneer only knows afterwards what he should have known before. That's Collected Works 18, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4. I want to go to animus and anima for a little now in the personal equation. Jung added greatly to our understanding of ourselves with his concepts of anima and animus. The feminine and typological opposite present within the masculine, and the masculine and typological opposite present within the feminine. Jung looked inside himself and described the feminine aspect of his being, which he called the anima. In Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, he describes her as sometimes blind, sometimes as snake-like and clinging, sometimes as over-impressed and over-complimentary to him, and often as untrustworthy. As an undeveloped aspect of himself, these are all valuable insights, but cause trouble when the undeveloped feminine in Jung, this sometimes hysterical and over-emotional aspect of the feminine, is then in the vision seminars projected onto women and women's psychology. I don't have time, do I, to go into animus and anima. And I think we should stop maybe just about here. Pretty soon. Around now. Okay. So I am going to stop and I will, anything that I think valuable here, I will bring in tomorrow. But anima animus. All right. I was going to, thank you. I was going to give you what Jung was working through about the animus in the vision seminars. And here, I think he talks better in the vision seminars than anywhere else about the animus is positive and its good function. It's true function. Here he says, the animus fulfills his true function in helping. Therefore, I've defined the animus as well as the anima as mediators or links or functions of relationship. Imagine the animus as a function of relationship, but in its positive sense, it certainly is, between the conscious and the unconscious. Here, he really functions as such. He's in the proper place as a bridge. He helps her to cross to the other side, whatever the other side may be. And then he quotes from one of the visions, "Come with me, my beautiful one." I took him by the hand, but he couldn't come. He struggled to maintain his balance, and then he fell in the water at the bottom of the chasm. He goes on to say that the animus helped lead her to a place, to the unconscious, but then she had to cross by herself. In another place, he talks about the animus. Then, if the animus or the anima are in their proper place, they cannot possess the human being. Instead, the human being is in control. The natural function of the animus is to remain in his place between the individual consciousness and the collective unconscious, exactly as the persona is a sort of stratum between the ego conscious and the objects of the external world. The animus should function as a bridge or a door leading to the images of the collective unconscious, as the persona should be a sort of bridge into the world, which allows you to be reasonably protected and to have a reasonable amount of influence in other people. But if you have the negative animus, this animus system of opinions is in a way a good shield against the collective unconscious. It's an adequate instrument. For the animus always knows what would be good, not for yourself, but for the generality, everybody. It is an exceedingly collective thing. He's talking about the negative animus. And this is the proper weapon for another collective thing, but it doesn't help you at all in your individual case. In the individual case, you crush a thing if you treat it with a negative animus, as you lock the mouth of everybody else when you argue a thing with an animus. It's so absolutely opposed to the real point that any argument comes to an end right away. For instance, when in an individual case you say something ought to be so and so, that dismisses the argument. As soon as you use that word, you declare there's nothing to be done, like the oughts and shoulds. The animus is so irritating and ridiculous because it represents a problem as if it were not an individual reality, but a multitude of average abstract cases. It always wants to settle the problem in a general way, to formulate it as it ought to be for a duration of at least 500 years and for a multitude of people at the same time. But that's absolutely futile for the individual mind. As I've explained several times before, it's not a matter of what the 11,000 virgins ought to do, but what you yourself is going to do, which is altogether different. That one's on page 127 to 128. The first thing I read was on page 201. And finally, the proper relation to the animus and the anima is on page 530. He was answering a question about projection, and Jung says it's no longer projected, it's the animus that has been outside of herself. Then comes the moment of rebirth when she assimilates the animus and begins to understand that it's a psychological function within herself. For the first time in history, the animus appears as a human function. All these animas and animi have never been part of human psychology. They've always been projected. Therefore, I once said it looked to me as if the human mind had grown out of external objects all over the world, as if our consciousness really started with the stars and not in the brain, and as if we were beginning to assimilate these psychological facts only in our time. In the Middle Ages, when a man discovered an anima, he got the thing arrested, and the judge had her burned up as a witch. All too true. Or perhaps a woman discovered an animus, and that man was doomed to become a saint or a savior or a great medicine man. A medicine man is always made by projection. So only now, by the analytic process, do the anima and animus that were always outside begin to transform into psychological functions and be of use. So that's what I was going to read. Thank you for asking. Oh, who could answer that? How could you answer that? It would seem as if so. Yeah. I don't know enough. Oh, I wish somebody knew, because that's a fascinating question. Yeah. It's in the matter. Which brings me to Kundalini Yoga, which is again the way of how to get the opposites together. So the archetypes coming up from below or the archetypes coming down from the heavens. And if any of you are interested in Eastern religions or in Kundalini Yoga or in Qi or in power centers, Jung is very, very good here linking the different chakras to the different visions that this woman is having. And here it is as if he's allowing the animus or the archetype or whatever to have different positions. That there are some that come from the sexual chakra that are very spiritual, and some that come from the crown chakra that are very going downward, that are very filled with erotic or libido, not eroticism, but libido, and finding what in psychology, what in your life, what in the visions belongs to which chakra was brilliant of him. Part of the vision seminars was split off and into the Kundalini Yoga seminar, two seminars or four seminars that Sona Sham Dasani edited. But it just reminded me of that. Questions? Yeah?
That's a great thing, you're mentioning the difference between spring, birth, and spring.
Yes. In this version, I edited out duplications so that he used to tell the same story over and over and over again. I usually edited them out. I edited out a lot of, no, I inserted a lot of commas. There was no punctuation because this was not written by Jung. This was recorded by somebody else and then Jung looked at it. But the punctuation was abominable. I think that's all. I tried to be as faithful to it as I possibly could, except when I couldn't. Regaining my appreciation of Jung and getting really not only to admire him but to in a very deep way love him and fight him both. Yeah, thank you for asking that. Oh, wonderful. What led you to ask that question? I think it's a marvelous question. Yeah. And what does that mean? Yeah. I think you need to write about that because I don't know. As a thinking type, it works wonderfully for me. It works well for intuitives. Sensation types need to use the sand tray or something else. And I've had feeling types use active imagination, but they've been more often introverted feeling types. So extroverted feeling and active imagination, I don't know. What if it's not too personal, when you need to get in touch with something that's that you can't, what form do you use? You got it. Yeah. 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 Jung would, of course, then say to you, but that's active imagination. It doesn't have to be this sort of whatever this is that Christiana Morgan and Jung both did, this sort of highfalutin language and strange and very, very numinous. And this is all an example of bad feeling, I think, or inferior feeling, this kind of stuff. I know it well. Yeah, so but stone seems just right for you. Yes. Thank you. I wish you would write in it or get somebody to write about it. Or sculpt. Yeah. Because all his emotion, all of that. Yeah. Other questions? Comments? Yeah.
When I think of the analogy in kind of a psychopompo, a way of going between the two areas, I think of Dante, Virgil, got him all the way up, and then Beatrice saw him basically up into the Paradiso. And I guess I'm curious, and I think that maybe the comment you made in the beginning, again, it's all coming out of not necessarily a book. A lot of it was covered in some of this. A more of a masculine approach. Obviously, Dante was a man. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that that would be a type of the way that the positive animals might work in the feminine side. He's grown to a point where maybe then he can move into more numinous by a soul sort of an animal.
Well, you're being postmodern. Because, yes, today people do feel as if for me, the animus goes so far and then the other takes over. And I think we each have both in us. But most people need to develop their contrasexual first in order then for the other to come further. And then the interesting question, if you go back to old psychology, is that for you that animus, or for me that anima that starts showing up, is that an aspect of myself, or is it the anima of my animus, or This is what I love again about all the ideas in Jungian psychology, because they're alive, they can develop. They hold, even though they have to be lived further. Yeah, thank you. The first vision seminars I got, and when I'm ill or have a cold, my memory just goes first of all. Who recorded them? Mary Foote, thank you. Yes. She recorded them first. They were published in mimeograph form in Zurich, available only to analysts or students. And then Princeton started bringing them out slowly in publication. So all of that is there. The Christiana Morgan's visions were not out in the public. Only Jung's comments on them. And part of whoever it was that said that she got irritated with them, you, yeah. Yeah. And maybe I'm projecting onto you because I got irritated with his irritation. But also, he was, what I found out doing research, and I'll get back to the question I'm circumambulating, he was using not the original visions that I discovered. He was using a copy that she sent him when he said he was going to lecture on the visions and asked her permission and said, send me a copy. And she didn't send the originals. She painted new ones for him. And she happened to be in a really very, very deep clinical depression at that point. And so the ones, and when I saw them, and I saw them for the first time in 1997 in Zurich, I think, or maybe earlier, were dull, murky. They had none of the life of the ones that she really had. I told, what's your name? No. Kiffin. I told the story of how she asked how I got interested in these, and I was held back in my training in New York for a year because I was too primitive. And the reason was that women should have developed feeling functions, and she certainly isn't developed, because look at her feeling, it bursts out, it's this, that, and the other thing. And so the vision seminars, the mimeograph version my first analyst gave me to read. And I had remembered Jung saying, these will bore you, these you can't finish, these are a failure, this woman isn't getting anywhere. And somehow or other, something clicked in me that said, projecting onto Christiana Morgan, well, if I read one of these visions straight through from beginning to end, if they bore me, then my review committee's right and primitive. I'm not going to be a Jungian analyst. I'm going to quit. But I'm going to fight those visions. And so I set out on a quest and did a tremendous amount of detective work and got possessed by them. And eventually, very synchronistically, found them. They were in the Houghton Library in Harvard, two of her volumes of her visions, under Henry A. Murray. So you'd have to find some connection there. And at the time, nobody knew that connection. And then they were under Mr. Christian Morgan. But there they were. And then I could read them from beginning to end, the whole vision. And they didn't bore me. They fascinated me. And they helped me a heck of a lot develop my feeling function. But it's still primitive. So what I'll be lecturing on tomorrow are those two volumes, plus another volume that's in private hands that I also tracked down. Because it was life and death for me. Because if I had stopped being a Jungian analyst, I would have stopped living my dream. I would have stopped being who... I would have stopped a whole lot of things. So I'll stop.